I've got to tell you that when I read the first pasuk of the Shalach, I get, one can't exactly say it, but you'll know what I mean. I kind of get angry with Hashem. It just doesn't make any sense, and it's not fair. Imagine how different history would have been if God would have taken us directly to Israel, not the circuitous route. So what could have been affected? There probably wouldn't have been the eagle, because the eagle happened 7 weeks after they left Israel. And if you would have taken the direct route, they would have been in Israel in about 10 days. As the Rishonim point out, Yaakov and his sons came down from Israel to Egypt. It didn't take them 40 years. It took about 10 days. So they could have been in Israel in 10 days. And they could have got the Torah just before they got into Israel, and things might have been very different. The whole story with the Meraglim, the whole story with the spies might not have happened, and everything that resulted from that. Moshe hitting the rock instead of all those things, all the arguments that happened, all the machlokas that happened during the 40 years, all of that might not have happened. So God takes them the long way, making it inevitable almost that they're going to go through all these terrible things. And the worst part of it is the lame reason God gives us. Why did he do that? Vayehi b'shalach paro esham, v'loy nochan elokim derech eretz plishtim, ki korovu. Hashem did not lead them through eretz plishtim, although that was the shorter way, which is probably the correct way to read the pasuk, certainly according to the Ramban. He did not lead them through Eretz Pishtim, although that would have been the shorter way. Why? Ki Omar Elohim, because Hashem said, Pen Yinochem Ha'om Biroisom Milchomo V'shovu Mitzrayim. Maybe the people would get weak when they saw war and they would want to go back to Egypt. Firstly, they wanted to go back to Egypt in any event. Secondly, this is a real Sfek Sfeke. In Halacha, we have a thing called a Sfek Sfeke, which is like a doubt within a doubt. The first doubt is, who says there would be war? And even if there was war, who says the Jews would get scared and want to go back to Egypt? So to take them through all that, 40 years of trial and tribulation, understand, God didn't take them through the 40 years. That was because of the Meraglim, that they were there for 40 years. But he took them through the long route, which caused the whole Meraglim issue and everything that came with it, which might have been prevented had he gone the short way. Why? Because maybe they would want to go back to Egypt. Terrible thing. And look what happened the long route. Was the long route better? Look what happened the long route. They wanted to go back to Egypt. They rebelled. They argued. They suspected. They tried God. They made a golden calf. Look at all the things that happened the long route. Was that better? What does it mean when God says, how does God get away with this? How do we let him get away with this? You didn't take us the direct way because you were afraid maybe there would be war. And if there was war, maybe we would want to come back. And you, God, don't have it within your power to make sure there wouldn't be war. And you, God, don't have it within your power to make sure that we wouldn't want to come back or that we couldn't come back. What is this? It just doesn't make sense. It makes me very angry. So we've got to try and understand what really is it all about. Now, what's even stranger is a little piece in the Beis Yosef. I've often said that one of the things I found, one of the completely selfish reasons I like to give a shiur to real people, is because there's an unbelievable siyata dishmaya. The Ribbono Shel Olam intervenes in the preparation and in the thinking process because of you. So if I'm just learning on my own, then God will give me whatever I'm entitled to, which is not a whole lot. You've got to work very hard to try and understand what's going on. But if I'm learning with a large group of people and such special people as you are, then each of your schuyos plays a part. So when I'm preparing, God is thinking, you know, he's got to have something reasonable to say to these guys. They're good people, they're bright people, they're committed people, they're giving up time on a Sunday night. So the devotion gives me siyata dishmaya in your schuyos. So that's one of the selfish reasons. And one of the ways that siyata dishmaya plays out is what I happen to come across. It's just, the intersections are amazing. So I happened to be learning some tur with my son, with Moshe, and we're doing Hilchos Shabbos. Nothing to do with Parashas B'Shalach, nothing to do with Pesach. But in the piece we learned this week, the tur says, Ilmale Shomru Yisrael Shabbos Rishoyno Ki Hilchoso, Loi shol to bohem uma veloshen. Now the tur, for those of you not familiar, tur is key, a key chain in that halakhic process that we spoke about last week. The tur, so from the Gemara you get various rishonim, who in medieval times, some codified like the Rambam, some drew halakhic conclusion like the Rif and the Rosh, some just interpreted the Gemara, but the tur came along, who was the son of the Rosh, and he brought together the primary halachic conclusions of the Gemara's interpretation by the Rishonim, and the three that he focuses on are the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh. And with that, he's the first one who creates the order of the Shulchan Aruch, because then the Shulchan Aruch is just a summary of the two. The two is really the innovator. And so the two says, if brings from the Gemara, if the Jews would have kept that first Shabbos properly, no nation would ever have been able to dominate us. Just think, now you talk about, is history in our hands or isn't it? Had we kept that first Shabbos properly, just think what that means. So there would have been no Amalek, there would have been none of the wars on the way to Israel, there would have been no wars in Israel, there would have been no destruction of the temple, there would have been no Golus, there would have been no Roman Golus, no Babylonian Golus. There would have been no Spanish Inquisition. There would have been no pogroms in England and in Europe. There would have been no Second World War. All of that. Just one Shabbos. That's all it took. If the first Shabbos would have been kept. Where does he get that from? So the Beis Yosef. Now the Beis Yosef is the other key part of this. The Beis Yosef is the Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch. So before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote the classical interpretation of the two. And he says, Ma'isi la b'gemara, this comes from the Gemara, midichtiv, because it says, Vayehi bayom hashvi'i yotsu min ha'om lilkut. It says, and on the seventh day, they went out, people from the nation went out to collect mon. And that was breaking Shabbos. And we know the story that the one view in the Gemara, in the Medrash, is that that was done in order to teach the severity of Slavcha did it in order to teach the severity of Shabbos. He thought people wouldn't take Shabbos seriously, and he broke Shabbos so that he would be put to death for breaking Shabbos, and people would realize how serious it was, and that's why. But the fact is that first Shabbos wasn't kept in its entirety by the entire Jewish nation. And the result of that, Uchtiv Basrei, right after that, what does it tell us? Vayova Amalek. Amalek came. The Chos of Ma'ari Abuev, and the Ma'ari Abuev wrote, also an important authority in the whole chain of Masuras of tradition, Sheim Amalek lo haya nilcham b'Yisrael, lo haya shum am veloshon nilcham b'hem. Rashi hints at this too in the Parsha of Amalek. If Amalek wouldn't have attacked the Jews, nobody ever would have. When you think about it, it's crazy. Just think of what had just happened. The 10 plagues, Kriyas Yamsuf. Who's going to pick a fight with you? Why would you pick a fight with a nation that has that arsenal of power behind you, whether you understand where it comes from or you're not, who would fight with you? Nobody would do it except Amalek. That was the nature of Amalek. And Amalek demonstrated that the Jews are just another nation like any other nation, and if you get them at their moral weakness, you can destroy them. You can hurt them. Their strength, all that power is only if they're on a certain level, and if you can get them to drop the level, then you can get them. It's because they were afraid of the miracles that were done. After Amalek came and attacked the Jews, even though he was punished and he suffered, he opened the gateway to the wicked nations of the earth. It became okay to fight the Jews. So Amalek was responsible for, now if we look at normal causality, if you look at historic causality, you would say Amalek attacked the Jews and that gave the opening for future attacks to the Jewish people. Without Amalek, that would have never happened. And why did Amalek happen? Because the Jews didn't keep that first Shabbos. So now, if we have free will, how can God say, I'm afraid they might see war and they're going to want to go back? Why would they see war? Nobody would attack the Jewish people. The only reason they would attack the Jewish people is if they didn't keep the first Shabbos. Ha, so God, you knew we weren't going to keep the first Shabbos. That's what it's all about. It was inevitable. So what we're seeing here is, and this is a really important idea and very, very hard to grasp, but it's life-changing when you do grasp it, because it differentiates our relationship to sin from the relationship of I think, any other religion, certainly Christianity. And that is, sin is inevitable. Doesn't make it right. It's inevitable. And if it's inevitable, it's natural. That's what we have to get. We are so plagued by a Christian view of sin being unnatural. Sin is not unnatural. Sin is completely natural and normal. Just like death is normal. Just like darkness is normal. Just like winter is normal. Doesn't mean because it's normal, it's nice. It doesn't even mean because it's normal, it's good. It doesn't mean because it's normal, we should do it. It just means it's part of life. And that's why we're told in Chazal that tshuva was created before the world. How could tshuva be created for the world before the world if people hadn't even sinned? Adam hadn't even eaten from the Eitz Hadas. How could tshuva have been created? The world was created with the capacity for sin. It was inevitable that Adam would eat from the Eitz Hadas, because if he wouldn't eat from the Eitz Hadas, then there wouldn't be sin. And if there wasn't sin, then nothing would work. So that all had to be programmed in. Does that mean that Adam's not responsible? Absolutely he's responsible. So now what does punishment mean? Punishment now means, a much better word for punishment is consequence. So consequence is just the natural outcome of not playing by the rules. But it's inevitable. Can you imagine a child growing up and never breaking a rule? Would that be normal? No. Would that be natural? No. Would you want that of your child? No. But when your child does break a rule, do you need to punish him? Yes. How? Why? If it's right, normal and natural. So we understand it in our bringing up of children. We get it. We just don't get it in the way we're being brought up by God. That it's normal. To break rules is normal. To experiment, to explore, to adventure. What does it mean? God puts in, look at the mix he puts in. Free will, Hester Ponim, God hides, and Yetzer Hara he gives us. What chance have we got? No chance. He doesn't want us to have a chance because he wants tshuva to be part of nature. He wants tshuva to be part of the process of growing up. And you can't have tshuva if you don't have sin. And again, I'm not suggesting for a moment, therefore, that you should go out and sin so that you can do the mitzvah of tshuva, because that's not at all. That's not at all how it is. And we get punished for that, the same as the child gets punished for breaking a rule. But you've got to be able to look at it from a macro perspective. And say, from a macro perspective, it's inevitable, and therefore it's natural and normal, and that's how the world is. Does that mean I have to sin? No. Each time I sin, it's my own choice. But the way, even when I sin as an individual, the way I look at my sin is not as an abnormality. You know, there's the lovely story of the old woman who comes to the Rav in Eastern Europe, and he says, "I've got to speak to you about my son. I'm so worried about my son. He's gone mad. He's gone completely mad." And he says, the Rav says, "What do you mean? What is he mad? What is he doing mad?" He says, "I don't know what's happened to him. I brought him up like a good Jewish boy, and he's now chastening the Meidlach, and he's eating treif." But he says, "That's not mad. That's normal. Mad would be as if he was eating the Meidlach and chasing the chazan. But if he's eating the chazan and he's chasing the Meidlach, that's normal. Does that mean it's good or right? No, so we'll deal with it. But I don't say he's mad. He's not mad. He's normal." So we have, even when we deal with hate, we deal with, that's why Yom Kippur is a Yom Tov. How can Yom Kippur be a Yom Tov? And it is a Yom Tov. Yom Kippur is a Yom Tov. And in every sense of the word, yes, we have the tshuva, is the mitzvah of the day. But we don't get depressed over it. Tshuva, Yom Kippur is not a Tisha B'Av. It's not a time for depression. It's the most uplifting day there is. Because we're confronting chate as part of life. And we're working out how to deal with that, how to confront it, how to manage it, how to overcome it, how to raise ourselves and grow ourselves with the result of it. So our relationship to hate becomes one that is much more healthy than a Christian type of relationship, which is much more negative in terms of guilt. The idea of guilt, we don't have guilt in that sense. I was trying to think today what the word for guilt is in the Torah. Ashma, that's a modern Hebrew word. We say ashamnu by gadnu, but that doesn't mean I feel guilty. What word do we have for I feel guilty in Hebrew? Can anybody help me? I feel guilty. How would you say that in Hebrew? Ashamnu, that's modern. That's a modern Hebrew. In classical Hebrew, it's not really what it is. You can say אני חייב לכפר. I have an obligation to do atonement. I have an obligation. I have a chiyuv to correct. I made a mistake. I was rebellious. We've got more fine words for it. I rebelled. I disobeyed. I followed my desires. I followed my yetzer. We've got this, but the word for that guilt word, we don't actually have a word for it. So it's not about guilt in that sense. It's about chiyuv. Oh my goodness, I did something. What I did has consequences. I have chiyuvim as a result of that consequence. One of my chiyuvim is tshuva. And korbanos in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and slicha, and all the things that I've got to do, they are chiyuvim, they're obligations that I have. But that's a much more constructive approach to chet. So here, God is saying, oh, you see, if they would have kept the first Shabbos, then there wouldn't have been Amalek, and if there wouldn't have been Amalek, there wouldn't have been any wars. But you say, God, right in Bishalak, before they're even out of Egypt, you're already saying, they're going to get scared when they see wars. So you know there's going to be a war. That means you know they're not going to keep Shabbos. And we've got to live with that paradox. That's the way it really is, and the way it works. Let's take it a little further. So what does he really mean by this? That he takes them the long way because he's afraid they'll see war with Plishtim. So there are a few things that are interesting here. The one is Rabbeinu Chananel says. Well, Chananel, one of the very, very important early Rishonim, says that the reason that the Torah gives is not the only reason. There were clearly other reasons God took them the long way around. And the main one was, he says, Kedei laharbois lohem oisus amofsim, to do more miracles with it. He wanted the opportunity to do more miracles, and he couldn't do that on a short trip. And he goes through how often God does that. When he could get away with simple miracles, he does bigger ones. So when Daniel goes into the lion's den, he could have killed the lions. No, he makes a bigger lion miracle that changes the nature of the lions. The lions are alive and they don't eat Daniel up. And so with many examples he gives of where Hashem tries to often to make the miracle greater. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they're thrown into the furnace. He could have extinguished the furnace. He doesn't. He keeps the furnace going and they don't get burnt. So that God's desire to amplify miracles for us, when there's a need for a miracle, when we have to learn something for a miracle, he amplifies it. Now just hold that idea. It's not very satisfying, because firstly, that's not what the Torah says is the reason. Secondly, it's also not such a great reason to cause us to go all that way and all that trouble. It's not such a great reason either. So just hold it that Rabbeinu Chananel is saying he wants to do greater miracles. The Ramban says something interesting, and he says, it's not talking about the war with Amalek and those wars. It's talking specifically about the war that would transpire with the Plishtim if they took the shortcut. And the reason would be because the Plishtim would feel threatened, because the Plishtim were occupants of Eretz Israel, and they would realize the Jews were coming to conquer, and they would have to defend themselves. So if they went, and that wouldn't be because the Jews, that would have nothing to do with the Amalek business. So all the other wars were as a result of Amalek, but the Plishtim would come out and fight, and that's very close to Egypt. And they're just outside, they're out of Egypt a few days, and they're going to hit a war with the Plishtim. That's going to be devastating for them, and they're going to want to go back. So hold those two ideas in mind. The Rabbeinu Chananel saying this was about God wanting to do bigger miracles, and the Ramban saying this was specifically about the war with the Plishtim. That's the war God was worried about. ולא נחם אלוקים דרך ארץ פלישתים כי קרובו, כי אמר אלוקים פינחם העם בירותם מלחמה with the Plishtim. It's not just general wars, it's war with the Plishtim. Which is different to the way Rashi learns it. Because Rashi says, בירותם מלחמה כגול מלחמס בירד העמליקי והכנעני. He says it's talking about the later war with the Amalekim and the Canaanim later on. No, says the Ramban, it's talking specifically about the Plishtim. That's what God was worried about them seeing. But now let's move into some medrash and work from there. You know the halacha that we lean when we drink our glasses of wine, when we do the mitzvahs of Pesach. And the medrash says, the medrash says here in Parsha Chof, Medrash Yud Ches, Vayasev Elokim Esa'am, Hashem caused the people to go circuitously. Vayasev is from the word sivuv. So he calls them to go the circuitous route. Mikan amru rabbeinu, from here the rabbis taught, afilu onishu b'Yisrael, even a poor person, lo yoichal ad sheyesev, should not eat on Pesach if he without leaning. So although only rich people used to recline, even poor people have to recline. Shekach also lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu shenema vayasev elikim, because that's what God did, it says vayasev elikim. Says the Medrash. So where do we know from that we have to, where does this come from, the need to recline? So in the Shulchan Aruch it says, because that's the way that princes do it, that's the way that it's done. And the Beis Yosef says, if you're living in a society where princes don't recline, then you don't have to recline. But according to the Medrash you do, because it's not about, it's not sociological again. This is halachic and it's based on a word in the Torah. This has got nothing to do with the way people normally eat, or the way princes eat, or the way free people eat. It's to do with the word in the Torah, the word vayasev. And hasebo, which means reclining, and vayasev, he took them the circuitous route, is the same word. And that relationship between the two words is the origin of the halakha, that you've got to recline on Pesach. So again, if you go into the whole thing and say, yeah, but today people don't recline, so you don't have to. Today it's not an expression of freedom, and therefore you don't have... No, that's not the halakhic process. It's got nothing to do with sociology. It's got to do with the halakhic process in the Torah. And this was the halakhic process. It's because of the word vayasev. Now, that's also very weird, because it's very sweet to play with the two words, and vayasev means this, and that's the same word. But it doesn't mean the same thing. Vayasev means he took them on a circuitous route, and hasebo means you recline. What has the one got to do with the other, apart from the fact that they share a common Hebrew word, which often happens in Hebrew? Hebrew is rich in the opposite way that English is rich. I always think that English and Hebrew are the two richest languages, but for opposite reasons. English is rich because you've got so many synonyms, so many words you can choose. You look up a thesaurus and you've got a long list of words that you could slightly, each one has a slightly different nuance and a slightly different meaning. That's why it's very, very rich. The Hebrew is rich because it's got such a small vocabulary. And every word means so many different things. So every word you use has all these suggestions to it that play a part. So it works poetically completely differently from the way English works. And vayasev is a great example. So vayasev means circuitous, and vayasev means saber. But to draw a halakhic conclusion from that and say, because God took us out circuitously, we've got to lean. What does that mean? So we're going to learn two explanations as to what that means. Why the leaning is learned from the circuitous route, and what that connection is. We'll learn two different reasons. The one, if you think that the connection with Haseba and Vayasev is far-fetched, there's an even more far-fetched one, which is very beautiful, but it's very far-fetched. The Chizkuni quotes it, and it's from a piyut that we don't say on Pesach. Well, most of us don't say it. It's one of the Yotzeris and some shuls, and the German shuls, they say it often. Some of the other communities say it, but we've come to kind of leave a lot of these things out of our davening. But there's a Yotzer on Pesach, authored by Meshulam ben Klonimus, where he says, and the words are, very, very interestingly, V'zachar brit sabo, umipileshet am hesabo. And he remembered the covenant with his grandfather and caused him to circuit around the Plishtim, the nation of the Plishtim. Sabo is the grandfather of the king of the Plishtim, who was a grandson of Avimelech, with whom Avraham made a deal in Lech Lecha. So although for us it was seven generations later, the Plishtim somehow that family lived long. Maybe it was because of that covenant. And what was the language that they used in that covenant? Li ulenini ulenechti. Ulenechti ulenini. For my son and my grandson, the deal was that we'll have peace. So now how does the Chizkuni learn this verse? Just look at it now. So now it's interesting. Saba, his grandfather. So that's another, although it doesn't come, Saba comes from Seva. Saba is, although it's a Samach and Seva is a sin, when you switch Aramaic to Hebrew, we do that sometimes. So Saba really comes as Aramaic for Seva. It has nothing to do with Sav, with Sibub. And yet, because phonetically there's this connection, that's how far the poet will go, and the Chizkuni will bring that poem, and as we'll see, the Medrash does too, in a way, the Chizkuni brings that poem in order to explain the Chumash. So that Vayasev Elokim et Ha'am, so now we say, Veloniham Elokim Derech Eretz Plishtim, God did not want them to go through the land of the Plishtim, Ki Korov Hu, says the Chizkuni, because the king of Plishtim was a relative of the king of Parah. And that wouldn't be a good idea. Because the Jews would go to the Plishtim, they have a deal with the king of Plishtim, they couldn't even get involved in a fight. So what's going to happen? Plishtim are going to say, guys, back to my cousin you go. That's sort of weird. You're not going to fight with us, and you go back to and they'll see the potential of war, which they can't have with the Plishtim, because they feel bound by Avraham's vow, and they'll go back to Egypt. What else will they be able to do? But doesn't that throw a whole different light on the posse?
But there is a peace between Plishtim and Israel. Why would you have to fight them?
So they wouldn't, you're right, so it's a Biroisa Melchama now means the possibility of war, which they can't get involved in. So now the choice is either fight the Plishtim, which I can't do, or go back. There's no choice. So it's not that they would want to go back because they didn't want to go to Israel, because they would have no choice. They can't fight the Plishtim. The Plishtim aren't letting them go forward. What are they going to do? The Plishtim will escort them back to their cousins in the south. So that's the piece that they were concerned about. Now, where this links up, interestingly, is to another Medrash, in Parsha Chafhei, Medrash Zayin, where the Medrash says the following. Listen to this one. We say sometimes in this midrash, don't we? Taruch lefonai shulchan neged sorarai. What does taruch lefonai shulchan neged sorarai mean? And in Yedid Nefesh we say it, don't we? And it's a pasuk from Tehillim. So you laid a table for us against our enemies. What does that mean? Taruch lefonai shulchan. You set a table for us against our enemies. Amosai, when was that? What happened when they left Egypt? What were the newspapers saying? What was CNN saying? Let's watch this. How long can they survive in the desert? They're out of their minds. They've left Egypt. They've got some provisions. They can't go through Plishtim. Plishtim won't let them, so they're going to have to go through the desert. How long are they going to survive without food and water? It's not going to happen. And Paro must have been thinking that. Everybody was thinking, can't go on for long. Hayuchal kel laro shulchan b'midbar? Could God make a table for them in the midbar? I mean, he's done great things, God, but what's he going to do? Set up a restaurant, a chain of restaurants along the way? What's he going to do? It's not possible. May also HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what does Hashem do? Hey sibon tachas anone kovid. Where you get the same word again. Hey sibon tachas anone kovid. What does that mean?
He surrounded them.
No, tachas, a sibon tachas, he, from the Lashon Hasebo, he made them recline. He gave them, not only did he make a restaurant, but he made it with the most unbelievable ambience, and there were these beautiful couches and pillows, and he made it incredibly comfortable. Shinem, as it says, Vayasev Elokim es ha'am. Ve'echilom, and he gave them to eat. V'hayagov ha'sheman, how much food, there was an abundance of food. And the Jews and the nations of the world saw the Jewish people reclining and eating, and praising Hashem. That's what Taruch Lefonai Shulchan Neged Tzorarai means. Shantev Hashem and Roshi. That's what it means. That in our coming out of Egypt, we were able to eat these glorious meals, sitting at these magnificent tables. It was just completely incongruous, but that was part of the miracle. So now why this is important is, do you see how this links back to Rabbeinu Chanana? Right? God wanted to do extra miracles for them in the desert. What did he want to do? On a short 10-day trip, they could take enough food with them, the same as Yaakov took food when he came down from Israel to Egypt. They could take food to go from Egypt back to Israel. You don't need miracles. God wanted to demonstrate to the world his care for the Jewish people and the quality of life he wanted for them. And just imagine it. You would think, what would people want on the way to Egypt? These people, they've been slaves for so long. They're out, they've got their freedom. Do they care whether there are flowers on the table? Do they care whether there's a beautiful white cloth on the table? Do they care whether they're sitting on beautiful couches and chairs beautifully upholstered, and that the food is magnificent and the crystal is on the table and the silverware? Does it really matter if it would just be plastic throwaway stuff and that would have been takeout food? Would that have been so bad? The answer is yes. Or maybe for the Jews it would have been, for God it would have been. Yeah. That's not how Jews eat. It doesn't matter whether they're on the run or they're not. See, Americans eat fast food even when they're not on the run. Jews don't eat fast food even when they are on the run. Because food, the way we eat, that's a mizbeach. That's kedusha. Doesn't matter if you're on the run or not. You don't eat in a defiled way. You don't eat in a cheap way. You eat in a way which has some elegance and some dignity to it. And I know that our life is crazy and it's hard for us to do that, but that's part of the Gehenna in which we live. That's part of the terrible times we live in. We think we're living in these wonderful, privileged times, and in some ways we are. In some ways, we've never been in a worse time, where human dignity has lost its value. And for us, look at how the Jews ate on their way out from Egypt. And we've got living in the land of plenty, and we're busy eating junk on plastic plates that we throw away. Stay on the run, standing our coffee in the car. What's with us? What have we lost? We've lost it. We've lost what being Jewish is. Now, what's being Jewish? Going to shul and be kiddush after shul. And what's the be kiddush? Is that done necessarily in an elegant way? Not necessarily. We just lost it all. We've lost all the things that are important. I'm not saying Yiddishkeit is only about the way we eat. It's about many, many, many things. But that's just one of the things that shows our differentiation. That even on the run from Egypt, this was important. This was the way it was. This was the kind of dignity with which it was. And that's what God wanted to teach us in the world. And he couldn't do that on a short trip. He had it for that. You needed a long trip, because on a short trip you would say, okay, so he made some nice. They took some nice furniture with them and some nice kalim, and they made meals. It's a short trip, but to do that out in the desert for years and years, that's something that's amazing. So we realize the value of that. So when Rabbeinu Chananel says God wanted to be marbi nisim, he wanted to do more miracles, it's not because he wanted to show off and brag about how powerful he is. It's there were lessons he wanted to teach. We said last week, every miracle is there to teach something. And there was stuff he had to teach us before we could come to Israel. And this is one of the things he had to teach us. And we had to have time and opportunity for those miracles. So when we say we learn Vayasev, when the Medrash says, Vayasev Elokim et ha'am mikan amru rabbeinu afilu onish b'sor lo yechal ad sheyesev, it says Vayasev, and we learn from there that you've got to recline. So now with our new understanding, we can understand what that means. How is the Medrash interpreting Vayasev? Not he took them circuitously. The earlier Medrash is interpreting it the way the later Medrash does. And with Vayasev means he reclined them on the way out of Egypt. That's what he did. So now, again, the sentence now reads completely different. And it was when Hashem, when Paro sent the people out of Egypt, Hashem didn't send them through Eretz Pishtim, which was an easy way. Because yes, they'll hit the Pishtim and they'll go back to Egypt. So what did God do instead? Vayasev. Hashem took them in a comfortable way. Yes, it was going to be longer, but it was going to be much more comfortable. It was going to be a way where he was able to spoil them, and he was able to treat them, and he was able to show them luxury on the run. That's what Vayasev means. Which takes us into the last piece, which is the... is there a way to understand this piece of the Medrash without the second Medrash? So again, the first Medrash just makes the connection between the words. Vayasev, Haseba. God took the circuitous route, therefore we must lean. We inserted the later Medrash to give understanding that Vayasev in this context does not mean circuitous route. Vayasev actually means that they leaned, they reclined in the meals they had in the desert, and that's why they went the long route. But there's also a way to understand it, learning the obligation to lean from the literal word of Vayasev. So what does Vayasev mean? A circuitous route. When do you take a circuitous route? If you need to get somewhere, why would you take a circuitous route? So one would be danger in the direct route, which is one of the things we have. What other reasons could there be?
Experience.
The experience. You want to travel. So some people will take a cruise. You go to England on a ship. It takes 6 days or 7 days instead of 6 hours from the East Coast. Why would you do that? Because you want the experience, you want the time off, you want the, someone's like your image of Shabbos and the cruise. You want the whole, that whole experience, you want that cruise experience. And that takes 6 days, and that's okay. The cruise is not about getting there. That's only one little piece of it. The cruise is about the process. And when you're touring, you're in a country and you're touring and you take the back roads and you take your time and you stop off at the little villages and you walk around. That's not the quickest way to get from A to B, but that's what you do when you want the experience. So Vayasev, when it says, and God took them the circuitous route, so he wanted them to experience growth. He wanted them to evolve. He wanted them to go through it. When you travel from A to B, you don't experience any growth. If you get onto a flight in Los Angeles and you get off in Israel, it's a long flight, no growth on the way. It's not possible. On the contrary, what you do is you watch stupid movies so as to distract yourself from the pain of travel. And you have a drink or two so as to distract yourself further, and then you fall asleep and hopefully you don't notice the time go by. And you get there. That's not called travel. That's called transport. That's like transporting cargo. And you're a piece of cargo and you just want it to be... I've suggested to the airlines, they haven't taken it up, that they should just give anesthetics to us all when we get on. Just anesthetize us, lay us out, and wake us up when we get to the other side. That's what doctors do when they've got to do something unpleasant. Why don't you guys? And when I said it once to somebody in the industry, they said, that is what we do. The food is fatty. We dish out drinks. The movies are boring. We do whatever we can to get you guys to sleep.
All the coffee's decaffeinated.
And the coffee's decaffeinated, is it really? We do whatever we can to get you to sleep. But it's not lishma. They do it so that they don't have to work too hard. You're asleep and they can take it easy. But that's not travel. That's just transport. If you want to travel, take your time. And then you grow on the way. Each little town you go into, each little village you go into, you speak to the people there and you taste the foods there and you hear the music there and you see the different sights. And each of that inspires you in a different way, and you grow from that process. Hashem wanted them to grow. This is not a direct route. There's a growth that has to take place between Mitzrayim and Israel. So what is the idea of reclining at a meal?
Same thing.
Exactly. It's not about the food. It's not about eating. It's not about getting to the end of the meal. It's about having a good time with your friends, sitting around the table, having good conversation, learning some Torah, sharing some ideas, enjoying some wonderful food. It's about the experience. That's the connection of the Vayasev and the Vayasev. So that reclining then means not only that you need to recline. So now what do we do for reclining? We look up the dinim, halacha with a small a. What does it say? You've got to recline on your left side. So what does that mean? So you kind of go like this and you drink it, and you've been mekayim the mitzvah of reclining. Maybe you have, but you're missing it. That's not what reclining means. So you rush through the Haggadah and you rush through the meal because you're tired and you're half drunk, but you recline. But that's missing it. The whole idea is to have a good meal, to have a meal that consists of all the different parts of what a good meal is. And that's what reclining means. Reclining is just a metaphor for process, taking your time, leisurely. That's what reclining means. Eat leisurely. And yes, one of the things you do in order to remember that is to recline on your left side and not your right hand side. It's more healthy on your left side. But it's not just another thing to check off the box and say, yes, I'm reclining. How much are you supposed to recline, Rabbi? This way? That much? Yes. It's not what it's about. What it's about is has the meal been an experience? The wine you drank, was each glass of wine an experience? Did you grow in the process? Or did you just gulp it down because that's what you have to do? Vayasev means it's an experience. And this is something that applies. The reason Pesach is so important for us is because it sets the model for everything we do. This is not just about Pesach. This sets the model of Jewish culture. That's why Vehigadat Lebincha is on Pesach. You teach your son. What are you teaching your son? Just that he came out of Egypt once? You're giving him data? He can read that in the history books. He learned that at Cheder. Do we need a whole Pesach for that? No, you're teaching a child Jewish culture. Jewish culture is about what a meal is. Jewish culture is about the synthesis of of spirituality with physicality, how to turn a meal into a korban, what kind of conversation, what process means, not just about getting there, not just about checking boxes. By Yasef, take the long route. Sometimes you take the long route, because on the long route you can grow and you can develop and you can evolve, and that's okay. Some things take time. You want to make wine, you can't make wine overnight. It's not digital. You want to make wine, it takes a little bit of time. That's just how it is. And sometimes the longer you take over it, the better it is. There's some things, sometimes you need outcome and you need results. You know, there's a time by which you've got to have said Kriya Shema. You can't say, I'm busy with the process, it's going to take me another few hours. Sorry, God, I know it's late, but I'm busy with the process. No, there are some things that are time-bound. There are some things that have deadlines. But there are other things that don't. And that's why the story on Pesach with the five Rabbeim and Bnei Brak. And they didn't even notice the time. They were so involved in process that they didn't notice the time going by. They didn't even notice it was time for Shachris. They were so involved in process. That's what we're teaching children on Pesach. So when we get up and we rush through the whole Pesach thing, we check all the boxes and we do all the things and we sing all the songs, we've lost an opportunity to really understand what Pesach is. So now I'm not so angry with Hashem anymore with the opening phrases of Pesach, because look what it teaches. It's so amazing. And now I say, you know what? Had he sent us the short route, look what we wouldn't have had. We wouldn't have had the idea of Hasebo. We wouldn't have had the idea of what an elegant meal is. We wouldn't have had the idea of what process is as opposed to outcome. We wouldn't have had all these things we wouldn't have had. And how did God have to create this opportunity? For that, it was important that we didn't keep the first Shabbos. So look how it happened in terms of Bechira. So the first Shabbos wasn't going to be kept. That was inevitable. How was it not kept? By Tzlokha doing an incredible mitzvah. But he broke Shabbos. But it was the greatest breaking of Shabbos in history. It was a complete sacrifice. He sacrificed his life. He broke Shabbos by sacrificing his life for Shabbos. That was the breaking. And that's amazing, but it wasn't good enough to be able to avoid the Amalekites coming. The fact is, we didn't keep Shabbos, and there's consequence. Not punishment, just consequence. Didn't keep Shabbos, so we open ourselves to attack. Once we're open to attack by Amalekites, we're open to attack by others, and that's how the story progresses. So that's the piece. Again, not an easy bit to integrate, but I hope we'll have this online very soon. I'm using it, recording it on the computer.